Chapter 18 Prelude.
Warg riders,
Regis remarked to Alina and Wulfgar, astride their horses beside his pony. The troop was up on a mountain pass in the Frost Hills, overlooking the juncture where the Rauvin joined the mighty Cerbrin. A few miles to the north of their position loomed the Cerbrin Bridge, out from Mithril Hall's eastern door.
Some,
Alina agreed, shaking her head and looking quite grim. What do you know? Wulfgar prompted.
Drow, she replied. As many drow as orcs. Some saddled on wargs, others riding summoned spectral mounts. It is a small troop, but no doubt formidable with so many dark elf magic users in its ranks. Funny thing about wizards,
Regis remarked.
If they are ready for you, you will die horribly. If they are not ready for you, they will die horribly.
He narrowed a sly eye to each of his companions in turn, a mischievous grin on his face.
They ride in anticipation of the fight, no doubt, said Alina, which means that Hartusk is aware of this breakout attempt your friend relayed to you. A trap?
No, Wulfgar said with confidence. And we do not know that these riders are aware of Mithril Hall coming forth. Where is Hartusk and his tens of thousands were that the case?
Too far, Alina replied. And so he sends these swift riders instead. Then it is still the time to fight, said Regis. For Mithril Hall and for us.
He pointed down to the rivers, noting the spot where the enemy riders would likely cross the Rauvin, where there were the ruins of an old bridge that now seemed more of a scattering of stones than an actual structure. However, nowhere else around it were any bridges or fords evident. The warg riders would likely pick their way across right where Regis had indicated, that they could then ride hard the few miles to the orc encampments around the Cerbrin Bridge.
We can get to the crossing in front of them and fight them there, and there is where they will be most vulnerable.
He looked to Wulfgar, who nodded, and to Alina, who seemed less than convinced.
If their eyes are truly for Mithril Hall, then we will have complete surprise,
the halfling reminded them.
And if not?
Then we will fight them and wound them, Wulfgar put in, and kill many of the drow. And if we cannot win, if we are to die, we do so knowing that we have divided our enemies, and so have given our allies more time to break free.
Alina looked at him, the two locking stares for a long while. The knight commander nodded grimly, her determined expression revealing clearly that she fully expected to die this day. But so be it. North of the main encampment besieging Mithril Hall, the orc scouts that noted the movement of a huge dwarven force had three problems. First, unbeknownst to them, a pair of copper dragons, whose eyes were keener than those of an eagle, circled overhead, watching for them. Second, those dragons carried riders and could deposit them in position to intercept couriers in short order. And third, those riders were Afafrenfir and Drizzt Do'Urden. Or was he Drizzt Do'Urden? For those who knew him best would know him as the Hunter then, moving silently across the open tundra, a whisper of wind, a flicker of shadow. Tasmakella had put him down far from a pair of running orcs, far enough so that she wouldn't be noted by any of the Many Arrows minions in the area. With his magical anklets, Drizzt had little trouble gaining on them. As he drew near and finally had them in sight, the rangers saw that they were not two any longer, but four, for another scouting pair had joined up with them. Good, the drow muttered. Better to have them all in one place. He eased Talmaril over his shoulder and set an arrow as he ran. He let fly once, then again as he neared, and then there were two once more. Drizzt dropped the bow, drew his blades and came in with a forward roll, coming up to his feet in a slight crouch right in front of the two orcs, who immediately stabbed at him with their swords.
The ranger flipped his hands, blades down, and out the scimitars went, left and right, in a double backhanded parry that drove both swords out wide. He held the block longer on the left with Twinkle, allowing the orc in front of him on the right to disengage, and so it did, spinning its sword up higher for a downward chop. The expected defense would have called for the drow ranger to flip his right-hand blade, icing death, back up for a second parry. But the hunter didn't play by conventional expectations. Instead, with brilliant speed and precision, the hunter pressed with Twinkle out to the left and snapped that scimitar up and across to block. Not as effective a block as he could have attained with icing death, of course, but one that left him in a position clearly confusing to his enemies. For now his right hand was free and was underneath the defenses of the orc whose sword Twinkle had just stopped. Out snapped the deadly drow's right hand, underneath the block, and the orc recoiled and the drow launched Twinkle back the other way as the orc on his left pressed in. He could have moved forward and right, pacing the retreating orc and so driving Icing Death home for a killing blow, but he retracted that blade even as Twinkle moved across for a backhanded downward block and had Icing Death again stabbing forward, this time to the left, over the block, forcing the second orc back. Again the drow retracted without a kill because he understood the lack of balance in his scrambling opponents. He crossed his arms in front of him, Twinkle pointing diagonally out and up from his right shoulder, Icing Death pointing diagonally down from his left hip, and he sprang from the crouch straight for the confused orcs. Twinkle swept down and across, Icing Death swept up and across, and the scimitars scored identical wounds, hip to ribs, on the orcs, though from opposite directions. The hunter immediately pulled the blades in close and rushed between the pair quicker than they could follow. As his arms swung into his sides, he tossed the blades, which crossed in the air in front of him, and he caught them in opposite hands and now with his thumbs away from the crosspieces. He stopped abruptly and pushed his arms down and back, stabbing both blades out behind him into the futilely turning orcs. And around spun the hunter to find his enemies twisted and bleeding and stumbling. The openings were clear. The scimitars were swift. The orcs were dead. The ogre slowed, seeing the running approach of the smaller figure. Afafrenfir was close indeed before the behemoth recognized him as an enemy, and indeed was up in the air, spinning head over heels. The ogre reflexively dropped its club and lifted its hands to catch the puny human. And it did grab Afafrenfir, one hand clamping on each hip, as he came over and laid out straight on his back. Any watching ally of Brother Afafrenfir would surely have sucked in his breath at that dangerous moment, and certainly the ogre believed that it had just caught a meal out of midair, like a hunting cat catching a bird. Except that this particular bird was more an eagle than a wren. The monk drove out his feet at that moment, double-kicking the brute in the face with head-snapping force. Before the ogre could throw him aside, the monk retracted and snap-kicked again, one straightened foot after the other, his toes jabbing into the unfortunate ogre's eyes. The brute let go with one hand to slap at its torn eye, and it tried to let go with the other hand as well, except that the monk wouldn't let it. Afafrenfir clamped on tightly to that hand as he contorted his body and threw it into a spin, using the stunned ogre's distraction to his great advantage. With ferocious momentum, Afafrenfir looped and looped around, twisting the arm, turning the ogre's shoulder forward and down. The ogre stumbled. The monk dropped to the ground but did not let go with either hand, and instead bent the ogre's hand at the wrist, pressing it palm up behind the brute's back, then leaping up and driving the hand in front of him, somehow finding the leverage to send the ogre into a forward flop to land face down on the ground. The brute roared and shook its head vigorously to clear the confusion. As it opened its pained eyes and looked up, it was just in time to see the bottoms of the feet of the murderous monk as Afafrenfir descended from his high leap. Jarl Fimmel Orelson looked up curiously at the rocky mountain walls, noting the unusual rumbling. He was the leader of Shining White, the leader, in fact, of all the clans of frost giants that had come to join in the War of the Silver Marches. He and many of his giants had gone no farther south than this encampment, the western bank of the Cerberin beside the thick stone and mithril bridge the dwarves had constructed across that waterway. Many giants had died at Sunderbar, and a few of Jarl Orelsson's closest friends had been killed in the Battle of Nesme. Now, with the apparent retreat of the bulk of the Dark Elves, Jarl Orelsson had taken command of Many Arrow's besieging forces, with direct control over this one surrounding Mithril Hall. Hartusk had protested, of course, the warlord's bloodshot eyes firmly set on Everlund. But after the last disaster, where the dwarves had punched out in the north and sacked an encampment, Jarl Fimmel Orelsson would hear none of it.
"What is it, Jarl?"
asked Fingold Boomer Floki, one of the most notable frost giant warriors. Fimmel Orelsson looked at his old friend and noted the weariness in Fingold's eyes. They had won many victories, particularly early on in the campaign. They had slaughtered the knights in silver at the crossing of the Red Run, had obliterated the town of Nesme, had destroyed King Brom of Adbar and his dwarven legions in the Battle of the Cold Vale, had twice put Mithril Hall's dwarves and once Citadel Felbar's dwarves back in their holes. But it had been a long winter, and the most recent reports had not been nearly as promising. That second battle with the dwarves of Mithril Hall had left many giants dead. An entire clan had subsequently decided to return to the spine of the world. Farther south, Silvery Moon had held strong against the siege. There were reports of troubles in the Underdark, with the dwarves coming forth, and even one report that Adbar and Felbar had been joined again through the upper tunnels. And worst of all had come the hints from the northeast, from the region around Citadel Adbar, where the siege had been broken and an entire legion of frost giants killed. Jarl Fimmel Orelsson hadn't confirmed those whispers of tragedy from Adbar, but he suspected that something at least had happened up there, and that things had not gone so well for his fellow frost giants. And now he heard the mountain rumbling, and he didn't know what to make of it. That was because he didn't know of a similar event a century before, when the dwarves, besieged by King Obuld, had burst out through the eastern wall of this very mountain, Fourth Peak. Nor did he know that the mine tracks they had constructed way back then, to allow for the sudden and violent breakout, were still in place, and that the wall they had later constructed over the impromptu exit was not nearly as solid as it appeared. For it appeared as the natural stone of the mountain, and the orcs didn't even know that it was not. And he didn't know that the rumbling he now heard was a train of heavily laden mining carts, rolling swiftly down the tracks, speeding to a collision with a wall that was designed not to stop them. The last time the dwarves had broken out of this place, the mining cars had been full of dwarves, bold warriors ready to bounce down the side of a mountain to lead the charge. Not this time. The stones exploded, and the carts came flying through, high up on the mountain wall, flying and falling, and now scattering their cargo of flaming kegs of burning oil. The orcs and ogres, giants and goblins, scrambled under that rain of fiery death, of burning kegs tumbling from on high and splattering on the ground, throwing their flaming debris far and wide. Truly, the unexpected spectacle inflicted far more fear than actual damage on the besieging army. The carts could not be guided in their flight, and they mostly piled around or on top of one another. And their thrown cargo, too, could only cover a fairly small area, nothing the size of this encampment. For the monsters, though, the surprise was complete and terrifying, and that was what King Conorad was obviously playing for in leading with the attention-grabbing, horrifying spectacle of the flaming mining carts. He didn't plan to lose the surprise, either. From up in the hole of the mountainside came the fire of dwarven artillery, side-slinger catapults and ballistae launching their payloads all the way to the Cerberin Bridge, demanding the attention of the monstrous force. And while they had that attention, while they had Jarl Fimmel Orelsson roaring orders to counter the breakout on the mountainside, King Conorad and General Dagnabbit and the whole of Mithril Hall's remaining force came forth, the eastern doors banging open, a wedge-shaped shield wall rushing out. Jarl Fimmel Orelsson was still running around, ordering his minions to respond to the crossbows and catapults with a barrage of boulders, when he heard the commotion in the northeast at the eastern doors. when he heard the orcs, who were closest to that portal, screaming for support. The frost giant grabbed Thingol by the vest and yanked him around.
"Get help to that door,"
he ordered, and he shoved the giant away. He lifted his horn then and turned to the east, toward the encampment on the other side of the Cerberan Bridge, and blew three clear notes, calling the orcs camped across the river to arms. Then he looked around, surveying the area and the damage, measuring the continuing barrage spewing forth from the broken mountainside, and estimating the volley his giants might return. Jarl Orelsson was a seasoned veteran, and he nodded grimly. His forces would hold the dwarves in place long enough, he was confident, and the main force would roll down upon them from around the mountains in the north in short order. Many dwarves would die here, he silently vowed, and he looked back to the broken mountainside once more and smiled, thinking that their desperation would cost King Conrad dearly. In breaking out, they had opened the way for Jarl Fimmel Orelsson to break in. All around the frost giant leader, orcs screamed and goblins burned and dwarves rained death from on high. By the doors, the orc ranks were already breaking and falling back, fleeing in full retreat, actually, and surely they meant to run across the bridge and far away. But Jarl Fimmel Orelsson would stop them and would turn back the tide of the ambush in short order. He would fight the dwarves to a standstill, as he had reinforcements close at hand, and they could not.
"Come quickly,"
Wulfgar bade his halfling friend, splashing the last few feet from the cold water. The Silvery Moon raiders had crossed the Cerberan and rushed to the Rovin's rocky ford. Led by Regis, they had gone around setting their traps. But now the warg-riding enemies were in sight and approaching fast. Alina and the others had already retreated to the small wood not far from either river, and Wulfgar could see the knight commander at the tree line, waving to him, bidding him to hurry.
"Almost done,"
replied Regis, who was still on a rock in the river, easing a ceramic ball under its raised edge.
"Now," Wulfgar ordered, "we are out of time."
"Go, go," Regis said to him.
The halfling looked back over his shoulder and noted the enemy approach. They could hear the wargs in the charge growling now.
"Go or they will see you."
"I will not leave you to die," Wulfgar argued.
"I do not intend to die,"
Regis snapped back. And he held up a potion vial, one Wulfgar recognized as an elixir of speed.
"Now go!"
When Wulfgar hesitated, the halfling looked at him plaintively.
"Trust me,"
he said quietly. Wulfgar nodded and sprinted away, and Regis went back to his work. The barbarian tried not to look back too often in the short sprint, reminding himself repeatedly to trust in Regis. Alina was waiting for him at the tree line, handing him the reins of his mount as he entered. He leaped astride beside the knight commander and looked back, nodding, to see Regis at last running from the riverbank, his little legs pumping furiously under the influence of the potion, covering the ground with his speeding strides. The warg riders were still some way back, and Wulfgar continued to nod, thinking his friend would surely make it. But then he saw something else, and he stopped nodding, his eyes widening and his jaw dropping. And the riders around him pulled hard on their reins, forcing their suddenly nervous horses into a short backstep, shrinking back under the canopy. Above the approaching warg riders came two great white forms, shining brilliantly even in the dim light of the darkening, speeding fast for the river. And there was Regis running out in the open. Wulfgar started to call out, but Alina grabbed him, and surely he understood that he could not betray their position. He looked around frantically, the dragons coming fast, the halfling apparently oblivious. Wulfgar rolled from the side of his mount, hit the ground in a spin, and hurled Aegis Fang long and far, spinning it past the approaching halfling. Clearly startled, Regis stopped and ducked, and reflexively turned to watch the hammer as it flew past. In that turn, he saw the worms, and before he ever turned back, the halfling was flat on the ground, trying to make himself very, very small. Alina, Wulfgar, and all the others faded back farther into the shadows of the trees, and then those trees began to shake wildly in the windy wake of the speeding dragons, the air crackling, the wind rushing like a tornado with their passing. Despite the best efforts of their skilled riders, the horses shrieked in terror, and more than one of the raiders fell to the ground trembling. But the dragons apparently did not notice. They were already long gone, flying fast to the north. Wulfgar looked back to Regis, who, to his credit, was already up and running for the trees once more. But the barbarian could not keep his gaze there. He rushed to the side, to a small clearing, to view the departing worms. He had noted their passengers in their passing, a pair of dark elf warriors. "What do we do?" he heard Alina ask at length, and from her tone Wulfgar realized that she had likely asked him that question many times by the time he had noted it.
"Lady, we should flee this place," one of the other riders replied.
"Nay, we've come for a fight and we've found one,"
another argued, and so it went back and forth. Time was running short. The warg riders were nearing the river's southern bank even then, and Regis came to the tree line unseen by their enemies. Alina Brightlance took it all in, but seemed at a loss, and surely Wulfgar understood. The enemy force was here. The moment of their fight had come to them. But if those dragons had noted them and meant to turn around...
"Hold and wait for it,"
came the unexpected voice of Regis as he scrambled up on his pony. He had been lying in the open with a pair of white dragons soaring right over him, yet he, above all, seemed perfectly composed and ready for the fight. And Wulfgar couldn't help but smile when he looked upon the gallant little one.
"When do we charge?"
Alina asked, deferring to Regis, who had prepped the battlefield.
"Oh, you will know, good lady,"
Regis replied slyly, and he even tossed Alina a knowing wink as he patted the pouch of holding he had belted on his hip. He looked to the river and nodded.
"We'll all know."
And with that, Regis began handing out potions to make his allies stronger, to make them faster, to protect them from fire, to protect them from cold, to imbue the drinker with a veteran's understanding, to heal wounds. He emptied his pouch of holding at that time, every potion he had brewed over the last 10 days that might be of use, because he looked at the approaching army and thought of the enemy that had just flown past. The group worked diligently and methodically, time running out, to get the best enhancements to the person who would benefit the most. The archers who would remain in the rear were protected from cold, in case the dragons returned with their frosty breath, where the archers would be the likely target. Strength and speed to the front ranks, that they could hit hard and wound their superior enemy quickly, for the sake of their allies in the north, even if they were overrun here. Regis kept a couple for himself, including only a single potion of healing. He had enough tricks he might play, with his hand crossbow and his strange dagger and his hat of disguise, and he did not need potions the way some others did. He might be clever enough to survive, he tried to tell himself. But there were drow. He was full of resignation, full of steel, but full, too, of doubt. They glided up nearer the darkening, Tasmakella and Ilnazara soaring around with hardly a flap of their wings and with remarkable calm and silence. Drizzt glanced over at the other dragon, at her rider, Afafrenfir, sitting serenely and apparently reveling in the wind. He seemed to be looking inside, finding this flight a catalyst for his meditation. Drizzt nodded. He understood the feeling. He wanted nothing more than for the dragons to climb through the roiling darkness so he could see the sky once more. But of course he could not have that. They were up here for a reason, and despite the dragon's insistence that he and Afafrenfir should simply hold their place and worry about nothing at that time, Drizzt found himself peering down to the distant ground far, far below. They were over the orc encampment, the large northern one that housed the main army besieging Mithril Hall. To the north, not so far now, a second army waited. Drizzt's eyes, though, were continually drawn to the south, along the snaking Cerberin River. He heard the distant explosions. He saw the fires burning around the eastern base of Fourth Peak. He noted the dark masses, orc armies and dwarven armies, rolling together. As of this point, it didn't seem like Brunner and the Secret Army had joined in the battle, but it would not be long, Drizzt understood. Catti Bree was down there, ready to go to battle, and Drizzt would not be beside her. "Trust in her," he whispered to himself, though the words were lost in the wind. Tasmakella banked and swooped sidelong into a turning dive. Beside them, Ilnazara followed suit, though she veered out suddenly to the south and began to climb again almost immediately. Was she going to the fight at the bridge? Drizzt wondered. The thought nagged at him. He should be the one to go there, not the monk.
They turn, he heard Tazmakella, the dragon's voice tugging him from his private contemplations.
The drow leaned over and tried to get a view beneath, and could indeed see the orc encampment, much closer now, stirring and elongating toward the southeast, along the pass that would take them east of the mountain, with a straight run to the Cerberan Bridge.
Tell them, Tazmakella ordered.
Drizzt brought up Tolmaril and aimed the bow to the north. He hesitated and shifted, though, and let fly his silver-streaking magical arrow to the distant east instead. The flare flew and arced toward the Cerberan, cutting through the dark sky. It informed King Harnoth and his thousands that their trial had begun. Drizzt reached for another arrow, smiling grimly, thinking that Tazmakella would swoop down upon the monstrous army, affording him some wonderful shots. Giants, he thought. He would focus his deadly rain on the giants. But Tazmakella was not diving any longer, but climbing, lifting up once more into the magical darkness of the sky.
Are we not engaging? Drizzt yelled to her.
Wait for my sister's return, came the reply.
Drizzt looked to the south, but Ilnazara was long out of sight. He glanced down, shaking his head. He thought the dragons were supposed to ensure the route here.
She is nowhere near, he protested. If you are so eager, I could roll about until you fall from the saddle, the dragon replied. Perhaps you will crash upon a giant and help Harnoth's cause.
What is this about? He demanded.
It is about something for which you are inconsequential, Tazmakella answered, and about something for which you would be wise to remain quiet.
There was something in her tone, a deep unease that gave Drizzt pause. He wanted to ask her. He looked again to the south, where Ilnazara still was not to be seen. She hadn't gone to the battle at the Cerberan Bridge, he understood then.
Perhaps when he has his trophy we can return to Menzo Berenzon, Ravel said to Sarabel, as they moved north among the rear ranks of the raider force. I am eager to see what gains we might make for House Do'Urden when word of our grand victory spreads wide, and no doubt Matron Mother Quenthel will be eager to spread that word.
He looked to Sarabel for some response, some sign that she agreed with him, but she remained impassive, sitting atop her floating light blue disk, followed by other priestesses of House Orlauren and Sarabel's own handmaidens in appropriate ranks behind her.
We will find great glory, said a voice at the side,
and Matron Mother Xerath's two children glanced over and cast a sour look at Dumweel Armgo, riding a wretched-looking horse. She was the only one of the drow contingent riding a living creature, and not a fine one at that, while a handful of priestesses glided on their discs and Ravel and the other ten Zorlarans, associates of his in the days before he became the Archmage of House Do'Urden, all sat astride summoned spectral mounts of light that resembled the underdark lizards they rode in the deep tunnels. They hadn't expected to be on this particular road this day. They had been traveling with Warlord Hartusk's vast army as it made its sprawling way to the south and the great city of Everlund. Word from Bregan de Earth had abruptly turned back to Iago and his companions, though, and they had enlisted 40 orc warg riders to ride with them for Mithril Hall's eastern gate and the Cerberan Bridge.
"What do you know of glory, child?"
Sarabel asked Dumweel in the most condescending manner she could manage.
"High priestess, high priestess,"
a voice in Dumweel's mind warned, her sentient sword reminding her of her place. Dumweel was glad of that, for never had she felt so naked and alone.
"Killing Drizzt Do'Urden will bring us great glory," she remarked, but quietly.
Sarabel laughed at her, a horrible, mocking cackle.
"Us?"
Ravel asked with a smirk.
"You will know no glory, child of the Darthir," Sarabel chided. "Your veins run thick with the blood of the betrayers."
"Not as much so as the blood of our matron mother,"
Dumweel responded without hesitation, and clearly without thinking it through. The Zorlaran siblings scowled back at her with hateful, even murderous expressions. Dumweel recognized her mistake immediately, and understood too at that moment that if she had expected Matron Mother Dahlia or anyone else in Menzo Baranzon to protect her, she was sadly mistaken. Without even thinking of the movement, Dumuil glanced to the north, hoping against hope that she'd see her father flying back on Orbengross. But alas, she was alone. "Idiot," the sentient sword said in her thoughts. "Know your place." She looked back to the Zorlaran siblings and felt like a rabbit looking up at a pair of hungry bobcats. Even that image would be foreign to the dark elves, then scowling at her. Dumuil's heart sank as she thought of the rabbits. She loved rabbits, skipping around the boughs of the Glimmerwood. Perhaps she would see some this day. More likely, she would never see them again. "Do you understand?" she heard then, Sarabel's voice. She nodded meekly and said, "Yes, priestess." Knowing full well that if she had admitted that she hadn't even heard Sarabel's instructions or admonitions, that she was apparently supposed to understand, she would likely feel the bite of the vicious priestess's snake-headed whip. A disgusted look upon her face, Sarabel shook her head and glanced at her equally disgusted brother. "I will leave her punishment to you," she heard Sarabel say quietly to Ravel. Ravel Zorlaran chuckled wickedly at that.
"Perhaps I will summon a demon to join in our tryst," he told his sister. Dumuil knew that it wasn't a bluff. They neared the swift-flowing Rovin then, with the lead orc riders already picking their way across the rocky debris, the broken stone remains of a shattered bridge. Wargs leaped gracefully from stone to stone, following the familiar path to the north embankment. Several dark elf males paced them on their summoned lizard mounts, and of course the priestesses, Sarabel in their lead, would just float above it all. Dumuil just sighed, knowing that she was going to have a difficult crossing with this old and wretched horse they had given her. They reached the edge of the river, Sarabel floating right out, Ravel moving his mount with practiced ease from stone to stone. The remaining drow continued behind, and Dumuil let them pass. She'd take her time and cross last, then catch up to the group in the fields beyond.
"Smoke in the north!"
one of the orcs yelled then, pointing eagerly from his position halfway across the Rovin. Following his lead, the others began to cheer, for, indeed, a line of black smoke was rising to the northwest, across the perpendicular River Cerbrin, in the region of the eastern door of Mithril Hall. As Bregan de Aerith had predicted, the battle had begun. The orcs whooped and urged their wargs forward, eager to join in the murder. At the front of their line, a lanky orc with one eye missing and a mouth that opened all the way to its ear on one side picked up its pace and began a battle song, spittle pouring over its torn cheek. The orc's ugly lupine mount leaped far to the last stone, ready to spring from there to the north bank of the Rovin. But when its paws touched down on the stone, the mount and its uglier rider found that the stone was not secure, and indeed it flipped forward and crushed some cleverly hidden ceramic balls. The warg yelped, the orc shrieked, and all those around grimaced and turned away in a hurry. The area was bathed in bright yellow light, as if the sun had suddenly found its way through the darkening. The startled warg stumbled and splashed into the swift river, taking its rider with it. Not far behind, a second orc rider hit a tilted stone in just the right manner to send it levering over, and more light pellets cracked open, bathing the area in still more light. And worse, a vial shattered between the stones, a vial that turned out to be a flask of explosive oil. The orc and warg went flying in the blast, the rock beneath them lifting into the air and throwing out other stones in a spray like a volley of sling bullets. An unfortunate drow wizard just to the side was cut in half by the spray and sent flying into the water, his lizard mount disappearing with a dark flash and a whiff of smoke. A second explosion sounded as the lead orcs leaped to the north bank, and more magical light, stinging and awful, filled drow eyes. And then they heard the horns, what sounded to them like 1,000 horns blowing, and from the north came the charge of the knights in silver. Near the rear of the Many Arrows train, Ravel and Sarabel shielded their eyes from the infernal light. They heard the shouts and the roars and the horns, and knew they had to suffer the stinging brightness long enough to fight free. They saw the charge, orcs scrambling to the bank to meet it.
the enemy. A full cavalry unit was closing fast, bows lifted, arrows flying. Those volleys were not general. The Dark Elves, all the Dark Elves immediately recognized. They were concentrated and aiming for drow targets. Ravel winced as a wizard associate, riding up near the front and nearly to the riverbank, found a score of arrows descending upon him. His magical wards deflected the brunt of the barrage, sending arrows skipping every which way with flashes and sparks of purplish light. But then came another missile, spinning end over end, and before it hit, Ravel knew, and so did the poor wizard, that there was no protection from this one. The young drow mage's wards would not stop Aegis Fang. The warhammer ignited a burst of purplish light, but was not turned, crashing in with bone-shattering force and sending the young drow mage flying from his seat, twisted and broken, into the river. Dumweel had only barely moved out from the southern bank by that point, just one stride of her unsteady horse onto a flat stone. Cassidea screamed out in her thoughts, hungry for blood, and so she drew the sword and urged her horse forward. But this was no agile warg or spectral lizard mount, and the poor nag couldn't begin to find a path, stumbling and hesitating. Cassidea, the hungry cutter, would have none of it. "Forward to the fight," it demanded in Doomwheel's thoughts. But the horse would not move. Dominated by the sword, Doomwheel slid down from the saddle and leaped to the next stone in line, trying to fashion a path forward. Far ahead, the battle had been joined, she saw, with orcs and their warg mounts interlocked with the larger horses and human riders, mostly humans at least. To the side, a drow wizard threw a lightning bolt. A second held forth his hand and produced a small pea of flame, a fireball ready to throw. Dumweel grinned, anticipating the blast as she scrambled forward to yet another stone. She nearly fell, though, and slipped down into the water to her waist. Pulling herself back to the rock, she looked forward once more for the fireball. But the wizard still stood there, some 50 feet or so in front of her, his hand still outstretched, the small flame still burning on his uplifted palm. Holding that pose, he simply fell over, splashing down into the river, which bubbled and flashed as the fireball exploded underwater. Where the wizard had been stood a diminutive figure, a halfling, holding a bloody rapier. Doomwheel blinked. Then it was no longer a halfling, but a drow there, looking much like the wizard who had just tumbled away. She tried to sort it out, but Cassidea didn't care and wouldn't let her care either, the sword screaming for battle. It drove her forward hungrily, swiftly, recklessly. Perhaps it was an accident, perhaps more of an intended collision. But scrambling up over the top edge of one triangular stone, Doomwheel was met not by the closing enemy, but by Ravel and his spectral mount, the drow wizard in full flight back to the southern bank. The crash sent the half-elf twisting over and back, tumbling, Cassidea flying from her hand to land in the river with a splash. She saw Ravel leap over her to the next stone to the south. Behind him came Sarabel on her disc, and behind her many of the drow in full retreat. The river tugged at Doomwheel, with just her arms on the rock, just her head and shoulders above it. Confused and bruised, she held there, her thoughts swirling and jumbling. She wanted to cry out for help, for her father, but she could not. She wanted to pull herself onto the stone, out of the cold water, but she could not. Desperately, Doomwheel looked for her sword. She could hear the fighting above, close, even on the rocky ford, she knew. She looked around for her weapon, but it was not there. She wanted to cry out again for her mother now, but she could not. She wanted to cry out for her brother, but she could not. Her thoughts swirled. Or not, perhaps, she realized. Her thoughts began to unwind, streaming to clarity. She felt as if she was coming out of a daze, entering reality. Reality? Ugly, wretched reality. And she burst out in tears and cursed herself and saw again the blood on her hands. She could not bear it. She recoiled from it, retreated to a darker place, and there Cassidea found her and called to her. Doomwheel, little doe, let go of the stone and ducked under the water, letting the current take her. Back and forth the battle rolled, like the maw of some gigantic monster gnashing its huge teeth, grinding human, orc, warg, and drow to mush.
They had been outnumbered 2-1, and that without counting the warg mounts, which fought with fury. Wulfgar stood on the northern bank of the ford, his horse long dead. Orcs and wargs came at him. Drow hand crossbows and magic spells reached out and slammed him. But the son of Beornigar, his body and face red with blood, would not move aside. He alone held the ford, bottlenecking the enemy force, while his companions slaughtered those behind who had already crossed. No, not alone, he understood, as he saw a drow come up beside an orc rider, saw the orc go flying away, garroted by a leering specter, saw the warg drop flat to the stepping stone, a rapier slit into its brain. Wulfgar swatted aside the next warg leaping for him, but called out to Regis, seeing a pair of riders rushing in at him from behind. The barbarian thought to launch his warhammer, but he couldn't, as yet another orc jumped in at him, forcing him to defend. He did manage to glance back at his friend, to see the halfling-turned drow spinning around, some flask in his hand, which he threw out and down in front of him, between him and the charging orcs. The explosion shook the stones of the ford, dislodging riders, and demanded a pause in the fighting, even on the field behind Wulfgar. Regis's oil of impact bomb had gone under a stone and blasted it from the river, throwing it and a host of other rocks into the faces of the charging monsters, blowing them away in a gout of smoke and spray. Another orc came in from the side, but Regis brought forth a hand crossbow and shot the brute in the face. Victim to the drow sleeping poison, the orc fell to sweet dreams a moment later, but it found those fancies while it slipped under the water. Another followed and flew away from the second living snake of the magical dagger, and the third orc, coming in behind, found itself face to face not with the drow that had been standing there, but with a furious halfling wearing a blue beret and holding a magnificent rapier, thin and faster than a striking snake. The orc lost its left eye before it realized that the halfling had struck, and still didn't truly understand as it clutched its throat from the second stab of that beautiful blade. Wulfgar focused on the orc in front of him, now tightly clenched with him. He twisted Aegis Fang left, bending the orc, then jerked it back to the right with such strength that his enemy went spinning head over heels to the right. The barbarian called out to his halfling friend, and when Regis turned, Wulfgar saluted him, smiled, and nodded. He thought to go out there, but he knew that Regis, that spider paraffin, did not need his help. Some time later, Dumwheel pulled herself out of the river, Cassidea in hand. She gasped for breath at the end of her endurance. The sword had called her, had dragged her down to retrieve it. Caught in the current, the half-elf had drifted far from the battle, almost to the Cerberin, and now, drenched and freezing, her lungs aching, she crawled onto the field and collapsed into cold darkness. The drow had fled far to the south. Back to the east, across the Rauven Ford, their enemies had won. Alina collapsed into Wulfgar's strong arms, practically falling off her horse into him. For a moment, he feared her dead or gravely wounded, but he felt her grab at him, a deep breath coming to her. She stood stronger then, gathering her thoughts and collecting her remaining strength. "For," she said, offering a sly look, "including a drow." Wulfgar looked at her curiously. "How many kills do you claim?" she asked, trying to find some humor in the carnage around her, as if she needed to smile to stop herself from screaming in denial. Looking around, where a score of their band lay dead and not one had come through unscathed, the barbarian said, "I didn't count."
10, said another.
And both looked over to the eastern edge of the ford, where stood Regis, his bright eyes and white teeth shining out through a mask of blood. Alina turned to Wulfgar.
"You killed 10?
But the barbarian was shaking his head, still staring at Regis.
"Not I,"
Wulfgar said, directing her gaze to his diminutive friend.
"And 2 dark elves,"
Regis said with a bow. Alina hugged Wulfgar tighter, but but glanced around at the devastation behind her on the field.
Our troop is ended. Yet the fight at the Cerberan Bridge has only just begun.
We did our part, Wulfgar assured her, his eyes drawn to the smoke and the distant sounds of battle.
Drizzt was there, and Catti Bree and Brunner. The fate of the Silver Marches was in their hands.